All right, guys, today, first time on the show, I have a former professional athlete, an NBA star, John Amici. How you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Nobody's going to believe you. We start off with no credibility because you started off by suggesting I was a star. I think everybody knows that's a bit of hyperbole.
Oh, you are so self-effacing. Let me give the folks so that they truly know that you are an NBA player. Of course, in the era of Google, everybody could check this. Some stats.
Oh, so, no. This is what will prove I wasn't a star right here.
So you played for Orlando, Utah, and Cleveland. 294 games in total, 93 of which you started. 1,837 total points. That's not shabby. 228 assists, which is roughly the number of assists that Steve Nash gets in a game. 772 rebounds. Author of Man in the Middle, which I suggest for people to check out. And, of course, now founder and chief executive of Amici Performance, which perhaps we'll talk about. So you are a polymath, a man of many, many talents. So I thought we'd start by maybe sharing with you my own personal history with sports and how, in some sense, I envy you for what you were able to achieve. So I was unlike you, who sort of found his niche for basketball at 17, and you'll tell us about it, straight out of the womb, I was a soccer player. You know, growing up in Lebanon, you make soccer balls by crumpling up papers and scotch taping it and yep. playing with that. And that's how you get people from these countries that then develop such skills playing, because they play in all sorts of contexts where you really do become very skillful. And I always knew that I would be a professional soccer player. And then eventually, I also knew that I would become a professor. Then I had several very, very horrifying injuries. Also, I was living in Canada at the time in the early 80s. It was tough to transition to Europe, but the plan was to go to Europe, and other life obstacles. So my career ended by my late teens. On the other hand, in your case, your career started at 17. So why don't you tell us about the very different path that you took on your way to the NBA?
I started at 17, as I said. In fairness, I don't know if I found my thing in sports or not. I just knew that sport, being in a sporting environment, was the first time that people didn't look at me like I was a freak, like I was a danger.
Because you're big.
And like I was stupid. Okay. You know, that trifecta combination, I really found it really dampening to my spirit, if you like. And then I entered the sporting environment, and obviously people know basketball in England is bad. Basketball in England 30 years ago was really bad. But I found this group of people in a horrible gym in the outskirts of Manchester. And I walked in the door, and they rushed towards me. They rushed towards me and grabbed me by the arms, even though I knew I was terrible, and they knew I'd never played before. And it was the first time that I saw reflected in other people's faces. Instead of those horrible things, I saw potential. And I thought it was so intriguing that I had to, I was like, I am never, after my first practice, I said, I am never leaving this place again.
So in a sense, you found a source for self-esteem, which just happened to be basketball. But yeah. Had it been something else, then you're so it's very, very different, I guess, from my path. In that, you know, for me, when I played soccer, and I don't mean to engage in hyperbole, because I genuinely mean it. When I played soccer, I mean, it was mystical for me. I mean, the love that I had for the game, the sense of competition when there's a bunch of guys on the other team that are committed to injuring me, and that at the end of the game, I hope to come out, glide by them, and win. That spirit of competition, you know, was mystical, was better than, dare I say, sex. Now, in your case, once you found, you know, this source of self-esteem and then moved on to the NBA, would you be able to explain something similar to what I said, or you never got that?
I don't think I got that. I mean, what I found in that space was people who, where my enthusiasm and other people's goals and aspirations for me, almost, fit and work together. Whereas other areas, I mean, prior to basketball, I really, you know, in my family, we're a family of readers. We love to read books. We love to read books together as a family, which is a weird thing because you're not really, you're reading your own book and you're in your own world, quite literally. And there was something I loved about being reading a book, and then every once in a while you'd look up from your book and you'd look to the faces of your sisters and you'd look to the face of your mom, and we were all in our little worlds, and I loved that. And I felt very validated as a smart person. I felt very validated as a young person whose mind was intrigued by the world. However, the moment I entered the real world, nobody even imagined that.
Right.
As being a part of me. So basketball was the place where I first found it fit. I'm interested in being in this environment. They're interested in me being in this environment. It fit. I loved it.
Wow. Incidentally, you may or may not know this. I think one of the best predictors of a child, you know, having a good sort of life trajectory is the number of books that are available in the parents' home. And I can't remember what that number is, 200, whatever it is. And so definitely the fact that you had this familial place where you read suggests that you were certainly on the right track in terms of the life trajectory, right?
Yep.
Book loving books is an important, and of course, that's what, I mean, I do what I do now, right? I mean, I have the show because the ecstasy that I experience playing soccer is very much the same ecstasy I experience in navigating ideas, in chatting with interesting people, in learning from all sorts of folks. I don't really make much money other than whatever people gave me on Patreon, which is nothing, by doing this. It takes a tremendous amount of time, but it is awe-inspiring to sit with all sorts of fun people, and I'm sure that you would contest that you feel the same way.
See, and that's the thing. I think that's where we're similar in that I love hearing ideas. And more than that, I love hearing challenging ideas.
Right.
Ideas that force me to, because I really accept, as a psychologist, my experience is narrow.
Right.
My field, it's deep, but it's you know, not open in every areas. And I really like being challenged by an idea and then being forced to interrogate it intellectually, right. Being forced to kind of look at, maybe I need to change my worldview. Maybe I need to change my thoughts and ideas based on this that is evidenced. I love that.
Now, did you, once you went to the NBA, were you able to interact with fellow players? I mean, I understand that probably statistically speaking, most of them did not have your, if I dare say, your intellectual bent, but surely there must have been some. Did you get any folks with whom you could sit down and satiate that hunger for discussing ideas amongst your fellow players?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something, there's a really interesting distinction that to be made when it comes to sports people. Whilst many of them are not very academic, many of them have a number, if you like to split the intelligences up a little bit, a number of those intelligences. And I mean, I remember having remarkable conversations. I remember being sat in the locker room, pretty diverse in terms of racial makeup, locker room. While the OJ trial was being finalized, while that verdict was being read out. And you can bet there was a conversation to be had. I mean, practice didn't happen that day.
Right.
We postponed practice that day because we thought for our team, for our sanity, it was a conversation that needed to be had. And not just about the verdict per se, but about this issue of race in America, about this issue of whether this trial had been racialized at all.
Yeah.
And that was years and years ago. Some of the conversations on planes that I've had in the league have been remarkable. Some of them have been remarkable by their nuance and complexity. And some of them have been remarkable by just the sheer, this is a much smaller number, but the surprising stupidity of them, obtuseness of them. I remember having a conversation with a point guard, incredibly, I feel like I've already said too much now.
Don't say in Utah.
I'm not saying where. An incredibly smart guy who came up to me after a very long conversation on the plane with a bunch of players about race. Again, you know, one of the many issues that's been going on forever, it seems, had gone on. And he'd been listening to this conversation and then came up to me to talk to me about why are you people allowed to use that word, the N-word?
The N-word, yeah.
And I'm not allowed to use this word. And it was really interesting because this is a smart guy. He is a smart guy. He's surrounded himself with a diverse group of people. And yet, that's an incredibly dumb, obtuse question,
right,
for somebody who's been surrounded. And also, the fact that he came to me, it was because he thought I was less black because I speak this way.
Right. You love books, so you can't really be a true black.
Exactly.
It's funny you say this because I'll jump in with a similar story. When I was a doctoral student, being from Lebanon, I used to hang around with a lot of fellow folks who were from Arabic countries, but most of whom we're Lebanese Jews, and we escaped Lebanon precisely because we were Jewish. And one of the guys with whom I had developed a friendship at one point came up to me, and I've shared this story in other public contexts, and said to me, I really like you, Gad. And I said, well, why do you say this as though you're surprised? He goes, well, because, you're Jewish. I said, so what? He goes, but you know what? You're not really a Jew.
Oh.
And I said, no, I really am a Jew. But from his perspective, I was from an Arabic country. I'm not like those Jews, right? And so I was breaking the mold. So I think the guy who approached you was succumbing to the same sort of stereotypical thinking, right?
Absolutely right. I mean, and the thing is, it's frustrating on the one hand because a lot of the argument of people about understanding each other is this strange argument that if you simply thrust people together with no educational context, they get to know each other and they end up loving each other.
Right.
Whereas there are various parts of the Middle East where we know over the last X number of hundred years, that's not worked.
Right.
And it certainly doesn't work in a modern context in most organizations. It takes a little bit more than just thrusting people together and hoping by osmosis they get to learn about each other and understand each other and, dare I say, even like each other.
Right. That will come back to some of those diversity issues that you do it with your consulting work. One of the things that happens when athletes retire is that they say, they don't miss the glamour, they don't miss the shouting fans and all those other wonderful perks. They miss the camaraderie with that arises from with their fellow players. Was that your experience, that when you walked away from the game, you didn't miss anything other than those bonds that you forged with the guys that you went to war with, metaphorically speaking?
It's not that I don't miss my teammates. There are many of them. I mean, there is positively there's very little anyway, better. I'm still an NBA ambassador, so I do a lot of work with the NBA still, especially around Europe, Middle East, Asia. And we get together on a regular basis. So Dikembe Mutombo, Robert Horry, a ton of guys. Oh, who was here last time? Horace Grant and Spohn. So it's Muggsy Bogues was here in January.
The little guy.
Yeah. Because these guys are all guys who work with the NBA in one capacity or another, doing a lot of the outreach stuff, both corporately and kind of with the kids. And there is very little I like more than when we get together.
Right.
The sense of having been in a truly unique environment and one of the few who's done that, the respect that is given across the board because every player from total legend to me, average, every player knows that the skills that it required to be one of that top 300 are not to be sniffed at.
Incredible.
And if you've played more than a year, you're one of the very rarest, and it's truly amazing, that camaraderie. But when I left the sport, that's when I got wings. I've got to tell you, I felt like I could really do something useful because I was always plagued when I played by this idea. Well, two things: one, the idea that what I did for a living was ridiculous.
You were playing a game, basically, and getting paid very handsomely for it.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, if you take that reduction a level further, when you say you're playing a game, people can still rationalize, it's important entertainment or whatever. If you just reduce it a couple more levels to its real bare bones, I put a ball in a hole for a living for 20 years.
Right.
That is ridiculous.
Right.
And so now I was really conscious that when I retired from sport, there must be something with some kind of importance on a societal level that I had to do, as well as make a living as well as right. do a job that I enjoy, as well as do something for me that's intellectually inspiring.
And so did you know that you would you knew that you'd head down a path of ideas, but did you know specifically that it would be psychology, or is this something that you discovered, post your NBA career?
No, I've known I'd be a psychologist since I was 7 years old.
Wow. Very nice.
My mother was a GP, a family doctor. And like in all evil socialized medicine systems, doctors go to your house when you're sick, and I used to go on visits with her, and I used to watch how she interacted, not with the patients, because she'd be whisked upstairs to a bedroom to deal with the patient, and then she'd come downstairs, and she'd always spend 2, 3, 4 minutes with family members, and she did a lot of work in palliative care, so oftentimes the sick person wasn't going to get better, so it was in these scenarios where I really saw her do amazing things. I saw her with families that were so tense that the air felt heavy.
Wow.
I saw her allow them to fire at her all of their worries. Oh, I can't cope. How am I going to manage? What am I going to do when this happens? And she'd let them talk. And then she'd almost like wipe their words away and say, no, you can do this. You're going to do this and this and this, and I'll be back in a week. And then I would watch as they repeated back at her, "You're right, Dr. Machi. I'll do this, this, and this, and I'll be back in a week." And this was when I was 7 years old. 7 years old was 1977. Star Wars came out in 1977. And I watched Star Wars, and in the first 20 minutes of Star Wars, there's that scene where Obi-Wan Kenobi has got Luke Skywalker next to him, the droids are in the back, and he gets stopped by the stormtroopers, and they say, "These are the droids you're looking for," and he goes, Obi-Wan Kenobi says, "These aren't the droids you're looking for," and they repeat it back. I saw that scene. I looked at my mother, who'd taken me to the cinema, and I realized in that moment that my mother was a Jedi.
What?
I knew it.
What a great story. Well, you know, it's so funny that you say this, because one of the reasons why I'm very reticent to go to see a physician, I mean, other than the common sort of hypochondria, you want to not hear about these things, is that I usually have detested my interactions with most physicians, because their bedside manners, contrary to what appears to be your lovely mother, are nil. I mean, they have zero. Yep. If anything, not only do they have poor bedside manners, it's as if they go out of their way to be psychopathic in the way that they treat you, partly because of a God complex, and there are all sorts of reasons. And I've always been amazed that this, I mean, I guess medical schools do address it, right? They now have some seminars where they try to teach people, you know, how to be more empathetic and so on. But the reality is, I think, that empathy is really something, I mean, that is innate. I mean, some people are empathetic and kind and nurturing, and others are not. And you might be interested to know this as a psychologist, and I can't remember the exact study, but it turns out that the number one characteristic of a therapist in predicting how well talk therapy will go, is the level of empathy of the therapist. It's yep. not the prestige of which school he got his PhD, he or she got his PhD from. No. It's not all of the years. It's, are you somebody who listens well, who's empathetic, who gives out cues of, you know, and so if your mom, who's not at all trained in therapy, is more empathetic than the guy who's from Harvard, your interaction with her might actually be more beneficial to you.
Exactly right. I mean, it's weird you say this. There's a book up here from when I was in graduate school, and it has in it this. It was supposed to be a humbling experience for us to realize that no therapies are better than any others. There's no point in trying CBT,
right.
Neo-Freudian, whatever it is. None of them are better. It's all about these interpersonal characteristics. It's about a believable framework, someone that your client believes is there to help them, and some of these cues, these empathic cues that you're talking about. You know, I'm not entirely convinced that empathy is something you have innately. I think clearly, temperamentally, some people are more empathic naturally.
Right.
But I do think you can teach people how to be more emotionally literate.
Right.
And you're so right. This one of the consequences of what you've talked about, the hesitancy of people to go and see their doctor because of the sterileness of their nature,
right.
is that oftentimes men will go and see a doctor, and if they are not convinced, they often go with a faux complaint. So they'll go and talk about, oh, my shoulder hurts, and then the doctor will touch it. And if the doctor doesn't register that this is simply a pre-question to determine their mood and their tone to see if they're going to be willing to be vulnerable and talk about, oh, my goodness, I've got some pain, prostate, or I've peed some blood or something else more serious. We're finding out that people, especially men, are going to doctors and are unwilling to talk about their actual complaint exactly because of this interpersonal barrier, which costs the health service a fortune, because something that could have been caught right there in the doctor's office now doesn't get caught until it becomes so acute that they have to go to the emergency room.
Now, why do you suspect, or in this case, you're stating that there is this sex difference? You know, in other words, why is it more likely that men are uniquely concerned about that interaction, the failure of that interaction, more so than women? Is it that it's a question of respect? I don't appreciate the fact that you don't treat me with respect. Is that the issue?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, to be honest, I'd love to see some data on this, because I'm not sure if anybody's... I think once people realize this is costing money, that's as far as the research went,
right?
In terms of, now we know it's costing us money, let's do something about it. I think it would be interesting to find out why there's a gender difference. But I think some part of it is that... everything I'm going to say now will sound gendered, and I don't mean it to. But I think there are some cases where women look at going to the doctor, and if there's an ailment... they have responsible people who they are responsible for who must be considered. So however embarrassing it is to talk about this, I will talk about it because I can't afford to be absent from the lives of XYZ.
So pragmatism, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a strange pragmatism that for many men who, let's face it, too many of us are boy men, right. Are men who are still boys, the embarrassment of... you know, that I've just got a letter from my doctor about having to have my 45-year-old checkup. And there's some part of that, I'm fine.
Like I'm fine. Colonoscopy, I'm
not. I'm not going to go and have people poking me and stuff, uncomfortable, embarrassing procedures. I'm fine.
Right, right.
And I just don't, see my sister, my family has a history of breast cancer. My mother died of it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And my sister just has none of that kind of... privilege that I'm exhibiting, or stupidity that I'm exhibiting. She just says, I've got two young children, I've got a husband, I'm going to make sure that I do everything I can to be around as long as possible for them.
Right.
And I think that might be part of it.
Very interesting. Not a natural segue, but one that we must cover. Of course, you are one of the few professional athletes that has openly come out with your sexual orientation. Incidentally, and you will probably know this name because you're British, but many of the viewers won't. Can you guess who might be the first person that I ever heard of as a gay man? Given the fact that you're British, I'm giving you a big hint. Let's see if you got your... I'll even give you a second hint. Let's see if you've got your football history clear, or your soccer history, basically. No?
So, well, I mean, the only football player I know of is Justin Fashion.
Look at you, big man on campus, right?
Yeah, yes. There we go.
They're very nice. So for those of you who don't know, Justin Fashion was a footballer, early 80s, for Norwich City, came out as gay, then eventually moved, I think, to the United States, was accused of having sexually assaulted a 17-year-old. He claimed that it was consensual. And then he was so concerned that he may not get a fair trial, left the United States, and then tragically ended up committing suicide, I think, in Britain. Did I get the story right?
Yeah. In a garage in Britain.
Exactly. And that was the first time that I had ever heard that. So before we get into your story and, you know, the dynamics of that as an NBA star, did you know of his story growing up? And did that in any way, if yes... you know, affect your own coming out?
There is no athlete either in the closet who I know or who is out who I know who doesn't know that story.
Really?
I certainly knew about it. It's like the ultimate cautionary tale.
Right.
And I mean, I think what happened to him legally in the States was an outrage when you look at the facts. But I think what's even more disturbing to me, forgetting that entirely, is the way he was treated by his team. His manager was so crassly cruel.
You're talking about Brian Clough?
Brian Clough.
Yeah, exactly.
The things he said, I think, are unforgivable. And I don't really mean, I don't mean in a legal kind of way. I just mean...
As a human.
Just as a human being, as a giant amongst men, as a person who influences the conversation so greatly, they're the kind of words that should never be spoken. And then his brother. Good Lord, yes. Do I dislike his brother.
It's true.
His brother was the one who went into the newspapers and said, I don't blame people for not wanting to shower with him. I don't want to shower with him.
Wow.
And I just think, you know, so that for me was a cautionary tale, but I didn't really need much of one because I lived in America for so long.
Right.
And you know, some of the, you know, when I came out publicly, I was out to my family and friends and some of my teammates.
Oh, so your teammates, while you were playing, a lot of them knew. But yet nobody clearly violated your confidence ever.
Yep.
Incredible, right? I mean, yeah. You took a lot. It took a lot of trust on your part to make that jump, no?
Well, this is the thing, right? This is the difference between a team and a group.
Right.
You trust the team.
Right.
Groups, not so much. They are, people use those words like they're synonyms, and they're not the same. But on the units that I was with, on the professional squads that I was with that were teams, I knew I could trust to talk to people. On the ones that were just collections of talented individuals, I knew that it was not a place for me to talk. But nonetheless, you know, when I came out in 2007, my worry was extreme. I was really concerned. I was concerned because Americans have a penchant for guns, and I'm not bulletproof. I was concerned because the conversation around sexuality was so non-nuanced at that point. I mean, my first interview was with the company ESPN that published my book the first time around.
Right.
My first interview, my first question was, after this lovely woman said to me, well, you know, don't worry about it. You know, obviously we just want to promote this the best as we can, and I'll go easy on you. She laughed. And then, right, action, rolling, whatever it was they said. And the first question was, so, John.
Oh, no. I'm afraid to hear what you're going to say. Okay, go ahead.
Are you HIV positive?
Oh, Jesus.
It was my first question. I said, are you kidding me?
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, and then she said, oh, I'm so sorry, so sorry. Reset. Right. Hello, John. Welcome. I'm assuming you're HIV negative. Was her second question.
Wow.
And that was the level of the conversation. And I often remind people, I spoke to Jason Collins the other day, and I was like, I just want to remind you that when I came out, that the president did not send me a letter. He did not pick up the phone and call. President Bush was not a fan. There was a different climate. And I'm really pleased that there's a different climate.
Now, did you come out of course, at some point, one has to say, look, I'm not going to keep this in the closet anymore. There's no reason for me to keep holding this as a secret. But clearly, did you feel that there was, the environment was right for somebody with your profile? You felt it incumbent to come out because there's going to be a kid in Iowa who is in the closet, who by seeing his hero from the NBA, I mean, there's definitely that element to why you came out. I mean, yes, you came out to be honest to yourself, but also recognizing that you're obviously a public figure that could help others by you coming out, correct? I mean, obviously.
I mean, I think it's important to be really honest about this, which is when I retired from basketball. I was traded to New York and I was just like, done. I went home. It was New Year's Eve. I went to a party on New Year's Eve, and then 3 days later, I was back in England.
Retired from the NBA.
Retired from the NBA. I was home, and I sat there in this apartment I rented, and I was just like, you know, screw them, screw all of America. If they learn about me being out as a gay person, great. I'm not talking to any of them. They don't deserve it. I really felt quite irritated because my career was essentially ended in Utah because I was less discreet than they would like. And I don't mean I slept around Utah. What I mean is I just, if I had friends, I went out to house parties and parties and all the normal things that every other NBA player does. It's just the composition of the room was slightly different. And they didn't appreciate that. So then I suddenly find myself probably August time at Pride in Manchester, because I lived in Manchester then. And Ian McKellen was the Grand Marshal. And he was stood on a pink Cadillac, of course, with really tight leather pants on, waving at a crowd. And I'm in the gardens of Manchester Cathedral. And suddenly I'm looking at this all going on, and Ian McKellen is just coming up, and everybody's excited to see Gandalf, right?
Right.
And so he's just coming up, and then I notice there's a kid almost hiding behind one of the tombstones, not far from me. And I look at him, and he's hiding there. Clearly, he doesn't want people to see him at this parade.
Wow.
And then Ian McKellen is doing that thing that he's awesome at, which is making everybody feel like he's there for them.
Right. You know? Bill Clinton apparently had that ability as well.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. And so he's waving at the crowd, you know, grandmas and granddads over here, couples and whatever else. It's everywhere. And then he looks in our general direction and waves. And this kid rises. I tell you, he rises up from like crouching behind this post and is waving at Ian McKellen unselfconsciously. And I'm not trying to suggest that I'm in Ian McKellen's league. I am clearly not. But I thought, if this is the impact you could have, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that's what made me do it. That's what turned me from selfish, horrible person into passably human person.
My goodness, you are so self-effacing that it's extremely charming.
Oh, thank you.
Now,
it's true though. I was all about me when I retired.
Right.
When I retired, when I got home, I wasn't interested in. I thought, I've done my philanthropy. I've built a community center. I'm patron or president of five different charities. Are like, my work is done.
Right.
And that was stupid. And that it took Ian McKellen and a little kid to remind me.
We'll leave soon this topic, but I wanted to touch. I know that there's at least two high profile, one is not former, one is still playing, guys who, in a sense, clashed with this issue. One was, of course, Tim Hardaway, the point guard for Miami. And mm-hmm. The second, who's still playing, I think he's now, 130, 140 years old, roughly, is Kobe Bryant. He's almost my age, for God's sakes. Not quite. So maybe you could give us a summary of those two situations. And given your interactions with them, is this something that had surprised you in them? Or could you have seen, I'm not trying to get you to badmouth them, but just sort of, could you read that this would be the thing that would be coming out of their mouths?
I mean, this is the thing, unfortunately. The way we socialize young men to intimate that a man is anything like a woman is the worst kind of insult you can have. And so to call a man a fag,
right,
to intimate that they are gay is the deepest insult, because it's as close a man can get in the stupid minds of many people,
right,
as being a woman. So you always know it's kind of there as an undercurrent. My thing with Tim was that I was actually grateful to him. And I said this many times at the, you know, back in 2007, I was grateful, because when I came out, there was this kind of gurning, ridiculous narrative that, what's the Michi want? What's he really all about? Nothing. We are post this conversation.
Okay.
You can be gay just as long as you don't show me in public, or as long as you don't try and marry, as long as you don't try and get
residential. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah, all that stuff, okay, right? And so this is not an issue. Nobody's a homophobe. And then he said this, and I was grateful. I knew it did a lot of damage, because I still to this day, I get a lot of emails from young people on lots of different issues, but including this one, people who are gay or have friends who are LGBT. And I knew at the time that he'd really galvanized a community of bigots with his words. But I also knew that it forced people to make a decision. It forced people to think, am I with superstar, all-star point guard Tim Hardaway in this issue that is as, you know, plain on the nose of your face as that many people think that or thought that in that time? Or do I side with this guy who's a super average NBA player and not even English? And not even American, right. Sorry. Do I... And people, I have to say, for the most part, I really felt like he galvanized this tiny minority, vocal minority, but he really got people to realize, wow, there are people out there who still think pretty Neanderthal things about difference. I was grateful.
Did he ever come to you?
Nah, this is my irritation. I know he's done a lot of work, and this is really selfish on my part. I know he's done a lot of work to improve himself. And I don't mean just in this LGBT space, just to be a better role model.
Right.
I know this. I've heard from friends of his. I've heard from colleagues of mine who I trust who are friends of his. But he's never apologized to me. And the conversation was about me.
Right.
And I just, if you played in the NBA, you're not hard to get hold of.
Right.
I can pick up the phone right now and talk to a dozen people if I wanted to who are in the league. That can be negotiated. It never happened. And it just, in terms of Kobe,
yeah,
his damage was, I mean, his slip was so normal. I responded to it. I wrote a New York Times op-ed about it simply because I got a letter off a kid. I mean, a proper letter off a kid who's had a poster of Kobe on his wall his entire life. He was a properly good basketball player, actually, in Los Angeles, who was a sophomore and playing on the varsity team. So, a talented kid. And he said that now that photo, he had to take that picture down because it screamed at him in his sleep. And it just makes you realize basketball players are literally giants, but people with the command of the media, who when they talk, people listen. They just have a bigger responsibility. And again, he's another guy who's actually changed in terms of his behaviors. I can't speak to what his mind's done.
Right.
But I've been really pleased to see him grab the mantle of sending a better message out more broadly.
Well, in his case, if I've got the story right, I mean, yes, the slip of sort of the swear is something that you'll see in every, I mean, you step on a soccer field, every second guy is being called that.
Yep.
Okay, that doesn't mean that we condone it, but fine. I think maybe the issue was that his subsequent apology was a, quote, fakish apology, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry you feel hurt by what you... It's right. It's never... Look, I'm sorry for saying a really stupid thing, and,
yes.
I take it back with absolutely no conditions, and yes. That's it, right? I think that was the problem, right?
I agree with you entirely. His apology was a typical, it's almost worth calling it a politician's apology now.
Exactly.
And it was unbecoming of a person who knows as much and has come from his place. Because he's far from your typical athlete as well in terms of his intelligence, his background, his internationalism.
He speaks Italian, for God's sakes.
I know. That already marks
him
out
as Italian. That's already half the battle won with the ladies.
There you go. So, I mean, it was a really disappointing response. But also, I think the real key for him was that to accompany this non-apology on a split screen was him saying the word. Because the camera happened to be zoomed in on his face on the bench as he said it. And so his face, his mouth, curled with contempt.
Right.
Saying that word was just a powerful image.
Right, right. That's why a lot of them now, when they walk around, professional athletes always do this, right?
As do I.
Oh, is that true?
I do, certainly.
Wow. And
if you know you're going to be observed publicly, even if it's just for a private conversation, to be honest, I always remember TMZ telling me at the Olympics a few years ago, I still do some broadcasting work, TMZ telling me that they've got people on hand, on staff, who read lips.
Incredible.
And it's like, oh, really? Okay, then. This is how we're going to talk from now on.
The innate need for gossip extends to all forms of expressions. Wow, incredible. Yeah. So let's move on to, and maybe that'll be a segue to you describing some of your own current work, coaching, right?
Yep.
First, we'll talk about it in the sports context, and then you could tell us about some of the interesting things that you do with your company. Now, I've got this sort of, not anecdotal, but this intuition that's not bore out by any data that I've looked at, that people overestimate the influence of coaches, and especially in some sports more than in others. So, and let me build my argument, and then you tell me where I'm right or where I might be wrong.
Okay.
So, for example, we look at somebody like Jose Mourinho, right? I mean, you know soccer. I mean, you know who that is, right?
Yes. I do, yep.
Okay. So Jose Mourinho, you know, comes out of nowhere. He used to be, I think, a phys ed teacher. He goes up through the ranks. He wins with Porto. Then he always goes to, you know, astonishingly successful teams who probably, if I got my Belgian Shepherd to coach the team, would have probably done roughly as well. And so he's somehow got connection to this brilliant strategy in his head that I frankly don't think is true. In other words, if you or I were to coach each of those teams, maybe arguably we wouldn't do as well as him, but I'm not sure that whatever talent he has is truly being measured via the 10 million pounds a year he receives and so on. Whereas I know for a fact that what Messi does on the field is incontestable in terms of how unique it is. I mean, you're talking about the 300 NBA players that are so unique. Well, okay, so let's talk about Messi. He's a one in a gazillion, right?
Yes.
And it's clear, and nobody can doubt that. So is it true that my intuition that maybe we overestimate the influence of coaches is right? And ultimately, it's the five guys that are on the basketball court that are going to determine. And at the margins, the play that the coach calls is relevant. Am I roughly right or wrong?
I think there's truth to what you're saying.
Okay.
I think we're inherently, you know this better than I do. This is your bag. But we're pattern-seeking creatures, right?
Right.
So I think people, especially with your Mourinho example, it's so clear that there's a magic bit that people don't know about. And so they fill that space with something that sounds plausible.
Exactly.
And so this team wins. This guy's the manager. There's a gap here. And in that they fill, this team wins because this guy's the manager. Why? Because this guy must be special. So we just fill all this space with magic stuff. So I think that's true. But I also think that sometimes coaches, when winning, especially in sports, is so much, it's very much like the 100-meter tape, right? When you've got just noses or foreheads that determine the difference between winning and losing. It's right there. And so even if all a coach is the differentiator at the tape, they have a huge role. And sometimes their role is nothing to do with X's and O's. Like I played for Jeff Van Gundy.
Right.
Briefly, in Houston, and he is a total technical guy.
Right.
He's all about the X's and O's. His book, I've got up here somewhere still, the book of plays, it's right. This thick.
Right.
And then you've got Doc Rivers, and it's not that he's not technically astute, but what he does is manage people.
Exactly.
Manages the egos in some part, and even on teams where there wasn't a huge ego issue, like with Orlando, and not because I was on it, it's just everybody on that team just wanted to win and play, and I've never been on a team like it ever. But even in that environment, he managed that and also represented us.
Right.
You know, when he thought we were being hard done to, he was the one who stepped up. The only time he got a technical is if he thought one of his players were being penalized or hard done to. And that was really confidence inspiring. But not in the traditional sense that we think coaches are important.
See, I think I completely agree what you said. And again, it would be great to have actual data on this. I think that a good coach, to say something synonymous to that is to say a good manager of people, right?
Yeah.
Even the greatest players, I mean, I wasn't an NBA star, but I was a competitive soccer player. If a coach told me to get out there. You're the man. I used to play the number 10 position, the playmaker, okay? Yep. Get out there. You're free to do what you want. Create. Now, this is consistent with how I play the game. Then he's imbued me with the right role and with the right confidence to play. On the other hand, I've had coaches that put restrictions on me. You cover this guy when he's going back. You're playing more on the right side of midfield today. The minute that you put a restriction on me, my brain shut off. And suddenly I became the shell of the player that, you know, the game before I was, where I was allowed to be free. So yep. I think what coaches do, I mean, there is nothing that a coach who's never played in the NBA, you know, I don't know if the Van Gundy never played, right? He wasn't a player, right?
I don't think so, yeah. No.
So he's not going to teach you or Kobe Bryant how to shoot better or how to play better and so on, right? But he could instill confidence in you. He could. So I think from that perspective, I fully agree. So I think we're on the same page here. Now let's take this discussion to how you use it in business context, right? I mean, you've got a company that does this. Tell us about this because it's all very interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've been interested in helping people solve intractable people problems.
Right.
I think there's been a lot of traditional ways and not very ingenious or clever ways to try and address people problems and organizational development problems. And I'm one of the rare, I think, certainly in the business setting, humanistic psychologists who work in this space. I'm not a systems guy. I do help people change their systems, but I'm very focused on how individuals and leaders can be custodians of a culture of a high performance culture. You know, coaching is part of that. Consulting and being kind of a, what would you call it, consigliere maybe,
right?
A little mafia like, I suppose. But you know, the person you can talk to understand if your direction is the right one. And then helping people develop initiatives that are really going to work and not just going to look good. Because the more I look around now, the more that there are companies whose words, the rhetoric on their webpage is so dissimilar from their actual behaviors within their workplace. And I think it's actually worse for a company to have this incongruence
right.
than it is for them to just say, look, we're a tough place to work, we've got some issues, and you're going to find it challenging. I have not seen the data on it, but I'm sure that incongruence of being told that this is a one kind of place and then experiencing totally another is actually more detrimental than just honesty.
Let me interject here, because I'm going to give an example of that incongruity in, say, my organizational setting at university, mm-hmm. and then I'd love for you to give tangible examples of what you said from your work, because otherwise,
can I ask one favor?
Please.
And I do apologize for this.
Please,
I need to plug my plug has gone and disappeared, and if I don't, I'm going to lose you in about 30 seconds.
Oh, geez, all right, go for it.
This is terrible. This is a terrible interview.
It's okay. They watch my beautiful face. That's enough for them. Hi guys, John is solving his technical problem. Is
sorry.
It solved?
Not yet.
Okay, don't die on me. All right. I would sing you a song, but I'm not sure if I could carry the tune. Where are you, John? Come back to us, John.
20 seconds.
So, sorry about this, guys. Not my fault. Part of the vagaries of doing these things. Almost there?
I'm almost there.
All right.
I'm upset now because I believe this will be the most popular part of this video.
This is the part that they cut and they make some viral part of it.
Oh my goodness!
All right,
we're good. Back.
Okay, so to put people back in the context, I'm going to give an example of the incongruity that you spoke of in the context of my organization, and then I'd love to have specific examples of that incongruity in the work that you do. So in my case, all universities, and certainly mine, will, as part of their mission statement, talk about we wish to promote interdisciplinarity, right? The breaking down of discipline boundaries. We want academics to be breaking down those silos and working with each other. And so several years ago, I tried to put together a new program at the university, what's called an evolutionary studies program, which would allow people, independently of the field that they're studying, students, to get, for example, a minor in evolutionary studies, precisely because evolution is applicable to so many areas involving biological agents. So we could study We can apply evolutionary theory in medicine or in psychology or in business or in medicine. We can apply it in fine arts to study aesthetics. And so I had with me the perfect interdisciplinary endeavor or initiative. And of course, what ends up happening, each of the leaders of the different silos or disciplines becomes very territorial in their defense. And even though the mission statement is we promote interdisciplinarity, the practice is very removed from that statement. So that's my example of the incongruity you're talking about. Give me some of that incongruity in your context.
I think the easiest one right now in a corporate setting is the idea of flexible working.
Okay.
Right? Which is super mundane, I know, for most people. And a lot of people equate this simply with women, maternity leave, women with families, which is ridiculous, but we do. But what I'm seeing now, there's nameless companies that I'm working with at the moment who really talk about, one of the things we know is that flexible working is one of the biggest factors that increases employee engagement.
Right.
Right. And this is not about employees who want to work less. They just want to have a little more control in a way that doesn't impact. Obviously, certain client-facing roles can't be flexible. If you're on a trading floor in an investment bank, the markets open when they open and they close when they close, and you have to be there. But there are so many other roles that could be flexible with no impingement on anybody else except for dinging the status quo as certain people like it.
Right.
Right. And so flexible working is in place in these workplaces as a narrative. You can do it. It's easy to apply for. But everyone I've talked to knows that if they apply for it, it impedes their chances of progression, or at the very least impedes the speed of progression.
Right.
So what is said on their website, what is spouted by, with all honesty, I should add, by their senior people, is not mirrored by the layer of managers, the layer of leaders directly above the majority of folk.
And so when you come in to work with a client, you're looking for these incongruities to then make them clear to the client, hey, let's close that gap, basically. That's what you're
trying to do. And the thing is, I'm not even I'm a realist, right? I'm not always saying that we can close the gap in the way I think it should be closed.
Right.
But with things like flexible working, you're just asking for trouble. In a lot of corporate environments right now, you're 3 years and you're out. You're 3 years and then you're moving across to try and find a better wage or a better advancement pathway, even if you end up bumping back 3 years later after that. It just doesn't make any sense to provide another way that people, employees might feel undervalued, less valued, or lied to. So they'll go somewhere else, especially when you're talking about smart graduates.
Right. You know, very interesting. Two stories I want to tell you about what you just mentioned. One, a personal one, and one I'm going to describe somebody else's research. So one of the things that there are many, many things that I love about being a professor. It's very much what I do. It's not my job. It's me. One of the things that I love is precisely the flexibility with my time. And as you correctly said, that has absolutely nothing to do, zero correlation with how hard I work. As a matter of fact, people write to me, they say, it seems as though you never sleep. How the hell do you produce so much? Well, the reality is I almost never sleep. I work all the time. But you know what? I love what I do, but it's on my own time, right? Today, I'm at home speaking to John, former NBA star, right? That freedom is intoxicating, right? I mean, it's that freedom that makes me, in part, be an academic, other than, of course, loving the fact that I'm an academic to pursue science, rather than being shackled, making a lot more money, but being an industry. You know, I always joke with my wife. Sometimes she looks at me and she says, well, why are you stressed? I said, oh, geez, because I've got 4 meetings this week. And she'll say, what do you mean 4? Some people have 4 meetings before lunch. But the fact that I have to be somewhere at points A, B, C, and D during the week is incredibly stressful to me. Simply, very much like how in the soccer example I gave earlier, when the coach restricts my freedom, I shut down, right?
Yep.
And so you're right on in terms of the flexible work. Now, here's the research I wanted to talk to you about, which might be something that you could hopefully discuss in your speaking engagements. There's a gentleman by the name of Robert Sapolsky. Do you know who he is?
No, but I know the name.
Yeah. Robert Sapolsky is an absolutely brilliant neurobiologist at Stanford who's done work. So let me give you sort of his background and then we'll link it to organizations. So he's done work with baboon hierarchies demonstrating that the cortisol level, the stress hormone response of baboons, given that they are a hierarchical species, is as follows. The higher up the hierarchy you are, the lower your cortisol level. Now, you might think intuitively, if I am the top dog, or in this case, the top baboon, that's a lot of stress. I got to beat out all these other aggressive males. I got to keep my ladies in check. That's a lot of pressure. Whereas the reality is the lower ranking guys have much higher cortisol levels. Now, someone took this idea, and I can get you the reference eventually offline.
Yeah, please.
They applied this exact principle to organizations. And I think it was actually done in a British context, if I'm not mistaken, where they looked at, I think it was in some public service, public setting, where they are very clearly delineated organizational ranks, and they measured the people's cortisol level across those ranks, and it perfectly replicated the baboon studies, where, again, it's very surprising. You would think that the CEO has a hell of a lot more stress than, you know, the lowest ranking guy. No, the fact that he or she had freedom, whereas the lowest ranking guy, I even tell him when he could take a break to relieve his bodily functions, that causes a lot more stress. And then downstream has a lot more health consequences because of this constant exposure to cortisol. So this is right up your alley. So, so anyways, I'll send you that other reference.
Please, that would be great, actually.
So, yeah. So, and the reason why I like to mention this example is because this demonstrates how we could link physiology and biology, and of course, in my case, evolutionary theory, to business, right? So as you may or may not know, the main area that I work in is at the intersection of evolutionary psychology and consumer behavior in particular, but business in general. The idea being that, of course, we are cultural animals. Of course, we are animals that are socialized by all sorts of environmental cues. But we can't negate the fact that we are also biological creatures. Our hormones affect, right? Give me a promotion today and watch my testosterone level rise, right? And so you know, I'm always dismayed to see people at business schools be able to perfectly study economics and entrepreneurship and consumer behavior and personnel psychology while never uttering the word biology. So in your case, is this something that you've ever thought about exploring, this intersection, or not?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I am I'm a research fellow at the University of East London here.
Okay.
And we have a pretty interesting this is going to make you jealous now.
Uh-oh.
We have a pretty interesting interdisciplinary team.
Bastard.
I'm sorry. I was going to mention earlier just to really piss off. And so I get chance to talk to some neurobiologists. I get chance to talk to some pure biologists. And I think it's important. I was talking about just earlier today. There's no point pretending that in some of the ways that this manifests in ugly senses today, that there aren't some parts of some older bits of our brain that if we're not really vigilant, can end up running how we operate.
Right.
And it's based on not on what your mom did or your dad did or what society you grew up in, but on an evolutionary imperative. And I think if you can't, again, I don't understand what you understand about it, but I think if you can't at least grasp the fact that there may be some behaviors, there may be some even group behaviors that occur that can't simply be explained by what's happening right now or what happened in the last 10 years, you're missing a trick.
Exactly. And I often explain to folks who are willing to listen that offering an explanation of something at the evolutionary level, at the biological level, or what's called the ultimate level, ultimate in the Darwinian sense, it's the ultimate reason why something has evolved to be of that form, doesn't negate the proximate explanations. The proximate explanations is the how and the what of something, right? As I've explained on numerous occasions, much of science operates at the proximate level, and that's perfectly fine. But when you have a proximate and ultimate explanation for a given phenomenon, then you've nailed the explanation fully. And it took me a while to realize that by, you know, structuring my message in this way, that allowed me to make greater incursion into the sort of paradigmatic walls that were being erected. Because a lot of people, and especially in academia, thought, wrongly so, that if Biology Boy comes along and trashes my paradigm, it's a zero-sum game. If he's right, I'm screwed. And so I've got to hang on to my paradigm. Now, the reality is there are some social science explanations for human nature that are incorrect. I mean, there's no way to reconcile them. For example, to argue that there are no evolved sex differences between men and women is astonishingly incorrect. Now, that doesn't mean that men are better than women or that women are better than men. It just means that we are a sexually dimorphic species. That's how we define our species. There are innate differences. Now, in the social sciences, that could be considered heresy, right? I mean, the idea that there might be anything short of your genitalia that is evolved across the sexes is a no-no. But for most things, I'm perfectly willing to accept that there is an interaction between our biology and the environment. And I think once you really explain to people that, you know, you're not dead by biology being right, you're okay, then they're more open to your message. Now, in your case, do you have similar stories about people's antipathy towards biological-based explanations in your work? Or what's your story with that situation?
I think the main objection that I hear is, and I've heard it in a couple of videos I've seen, both about you and with you in it as a in a conversation, is that what you talked about with that proximate versus ultimate, they think that you're trying to say that these people behave in this way because of this, and therefore it's not their fault.
Right.
They bring that kind of culpability, responsibility angle in. Whereas I talk about it in a different way. I talk about we do have more advanced processing. We do have more advanced schema, if you want, ways of operating that we can be vigilant with to make sure that our first knee-jerk reaction, our ultimate kind of stuff, doesn't dominate unless we are totally overstressed, totally in awe, totally frightened, you know, these really rare occurrences. And it's not to take away culpability. It's simply you don't understand the problem. And what is science about? It's about understanding the problem, not understanding the problem as long as it fits. You and I will both have theories that we loved.
Right.
That we really loved. And Pat, I don't know for you, but for me, things that I felt like I could apply in my work day to day. And then boom, someone comes along and either improves it in a way that makes the previous one pointless or proves the previous one wrong. And you feel there's no doubt about it. In science, we like to talk, especially to pseudoscientists and anti-science people, we like to talk about the impassionate and the objective. But there are some things you just get tied to.
Yeah.
When I first started learning about emotional intelligence, I was enthralled by this. And then all of a sudden, these new guys came along with a four-branch model. And then some other guys came on with it. And it's like, no, I just can't get.
Right.
It's better. It explains better what we're talking about. And not only that, it's more practical for application. So I just got to get over it.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, and to put it in the context of what we discussed earlier with therapy, I think there are a few Freudians left, but I think they would have succumbed to exactly what you're saying, right? I mean, your whole practice is built around a set of Freudian mechanisms. I mean, that's the approach that I use to help the patient. And then there is this sort of tsunami of subsequent research that says, well, you know, a lot of the content of Freudian theory is, well, suspect, to put it charitably. But yet there are still guys that walk around and that are perfectly unwilling to revise their theories. But of course, you're right that generally speaking, science is an autocorrective process. And if we are humble scientists, then we have to recognize that once in a while we say things that are wrong and that we have to just correct them. You're exactly right. Were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to say there's a video, I wish I'd been there, that Sam Harris was talking about how rarely nowadays, even though I know there's flaws and issues, how rarely you hear scientists in a room, especially with other scientists, saying, I'm certain of this. And how often you hear people say, I'm sure there's somebody else in the room who knows a bit more about this. Or, and even the trespass thing, which I think is really interesting in science, which is the idea that I know that my knowledge is deep but narrow. And I can surmise, I have a reasonably smart mind, I can intellectually juggle other ideas, but I also am aware that there are other people who are deep in that area where I am shallow.
Right.
And I think at least with all the failings that we do, that I think science still has, and academia still has, one of which was terrifying to me, which is the idea of safe space versus intellectually curious space. But
Don't get me going on safe spaces.
Even with that, yeah. I'm not going to start you on that. Even with that, I think generally there is, in the community of people who would call themselves scientists, there's enough people who they just say, yeah, I yield to this person who's worked harder and longer in this area.
Well, you know, I think it was with Milo Yiannopoulos. I don't know. Do you know who Milo is?
I do.
Yeah.
He and I are not friends.
Oh, you're not. Oh, okay. Maybe we'll leave that for another show. I had Milo on a few weeks ago, and I think it was with him that we were talking about something very similar. And I was basically saying that scientists, by the very nature of sort of their epistemological bent, they doubt, right? I mean, and they're humble about what they know and what they don't know, precisely because you're taught to view the world through that epistemological lens. And this is why, incidentally, I get uniquely offended when I have somebody interacting with me online, some random person interacting online, who succumbs to, I don't know if you know the effect. If you do, fine. If not, I'll briefly describe it. The Dunning-Kruger effect.
Dunning-Kruger. They're so stupid they don't know they're stupid.
That's right. But incidentally, Dunning was my professor at Cornell. So there you go.
Oh, that's brilliant. I wish I could show you right now. On my screen right now, there is a little screen cap of Dunning-Kruger. Dunning-Kruger proposed that given a skill, incompetent people will, and then that bullet point thing. I have that there so I can simply drag and drop it to Twitter when I need to.
Please send it to me because I waste way too much emotional time battling those assholes. I will send
it
to
you. It is a lifesaver. Let me tell you, you can just drop it and breathe.
Oh my goodness. You know, it's so funny because I mean, 99% of the people that I interact with are perfectly lovely, which is quite extraordinary given the number of very opinionated positions I take. But I tend to be very reasoned and respectful and so on. But there's that 1% that piss me off. And the thing that pisses me most off is when they succumb to this. It's not only that they don't know that they are, you know, lacking in knowledge. Is the chutzpah. It's the,
yes.
Right? So I had a young guy who I think was a fetus. I mean, literally, he must have still been in the embryonic stage of development, who was explaining to me evolutionary theory. Now, I'm not pulling rank, right? I'm not saying that somebody can't...
I'll do that for you. That's ridiculous.
Right? I mean, surely you're an amoeba. And I've spent the last several decades working as a scientist in this field. Might you have the humility to assume that all other things equal... You don't have to explain to me this or that, right? And so that arrogance, this is the type of arrogance where if he was face to face with me, I might have to go Middle Eastern on him.
Yes.
I could use that stereotype since I'm from the Middle East.
Exactly.
Right. So if you were, now watch, people are going to listen to this and are going to try to trigger anger in me by fakely engaging in Dunning-Kruger. Let's see.
Exactly right. But I do think that, I mean, there's an interesting point with this as well, which is we're in a weird space right now where there are people out there who, in order to grab power, are trying to make not only benign, but make a positive about being boldly ignorant, right. About being boldly underinformed.
Right.
And then these same people create animus towards people who are informed and intelligent, even if they're measured, because challenging a boldly uninformed statement or claim is seen somehow as elitist.
Right, exactly.
It's a crazy world where that's the case.
You're all arrogant with all your facts.
Yes, and that's the thing. I mean, I am arrogant for many other reasons.
No, you're not.
For many other reasons, right. but with facts, it's just like no. This is not my opinion. This is statistically verifiable in many cases, and if not, it's the understood where we are right now. And honestly, if it changed tomorrow, if a new set of papers were delivered, peer reviewed, we understood that things had changed, then I would change tomorrow.
Right.
I'm not a flip flopper, but evidence is powerful.
Well, incidentally, I mean, there are many reasons why the phenomenon that you're speaking of is prevalent in public discourse. But one of the reasons, I think, is something that one of my bêtes noires is postmodernism, right? Postmodernism, in a sense, democratizes all belief systems, right? I mean, there is no privileged way of knowing. There are just different ways of knowing. And who are you to say that your positivist scientific approach is better than some other approach, right? Who are you to say that climate scientists are better in understanding rain patterns than if I just stand and dance to the rain gods, right? And so I think a lot of people who end up being trained in some of these bullshit fields then carry that epistemological bent, if we can call it that, in the public discourse, right? Everybody's position is okay. It's part of the democratization of knowledge. Well, no.
I am deeply, I've got to be honest. I mean, I'm not looking at myself at the moment, but I'm pretty sure that it'll be translated in my body language. That this really, really riles me, right? I'm not suggesting people seem to have managed to conflate this idea that there are different ways of learning things to there are different truths.
Right.
The earth is not 6,000 years old. I don't care which version of deity tells you so. It is not.
Right.
There is no argument.
Right.
The level of agreement amongst climate scientists makes the argument against what that consensus suggests absurd. I'm not a climate scientist, but just on the convention of science, the conspiracy would have to be so huge for them to be all lying at the same time.
Well, apparently, by the way, just to add to your astonishment, I'll send you a clip of a Iraqi astronomer who argued that the Earth is flat.
Oh, I saw this. No, do not send it. I can never see that again.
I actually did a whole Sad Truth clip on it.
I'm going to look. I'll look it up just for you, as long as you haven't shown the whole clip, because it is so inane.
It's incredible.
And the ripples of applause are the thing that get me.
Yeah.
So we all have to sit and listen to inane things from people who may well be well-meaning, if stupid.
Right. It's breathtaking.
But you don't have to ripple your applause when they're saying things. Oh,
now speaking, maybe this is where we'll end. I could keep you here for another 5 hours as I tell all my brilliant guests, and I'm truthful in saying this, but maybe if you'd like, we could end it with the following, if you feel like covering this, because you tagged me on it on Twitter. Speaking of producers of inane, useless platitudes, let's talk about your friend Francesca Ramsey, everyone.
I know you're not a fan of hers.
So do we want to touch this, or do we want
to
skip it?
No, I'm happy to. Happy to. I think it's important because for a couple of reasons. One, it's a genuine place where I don't think we see the same thing.
Right.
And also, I think it's important because people who know me and people who know you would understand that naturally we aren't going to be in the same place on everything. And I think it's weird to have a conversation if we are.
Right.
So I don't know this woman at all, to be fair. I find her demeanor pleasant.
Yes.
And that's what I meant by I liked her.
Oh, gotcha.
But also, I think that it's this particular video, I think you clued to, is about the demonization of political correctness.
Right.
And I think political correctness in the way that I understand it is perhaps not what you hate so much. I simply think, and it's a phrase I've used all the time, and actually she uses in her video, which is that free speech is not consequence-free speech.
Right.
And if you say stupid, provably false things, if you stay crass, purposefully wounding things, there should be consequences that should have nothing to do with the law.
No problem. I'm with you.
And I think that's where I am with her. And to be honest, now we're talking about it, I don't remember what the rest of the video is about.
So it turns out, actually, even on the thing that we're supposed to disagree on, we don't disagree on. But actually, let me tell you what I take exception with in terms of her general position on things. So I view her as a manifestation. And I by the way, I didn't know who she was until people sent me links and said, hey, check this out. You're going to get pissed, right? Otherwise, she would have never been in my radar. I mean,
good friends you have who send you things to make you mad. You have the same friends that I do.
Exactly. So what she does basically is she really embodies the sort of quote progressive, and I say that as a derogatory term because they are true progressives, people who truly believe in liberal values rather than the ones who are the social justice warriors and the pathologically politically correct. So I'll give you an example, which I think will hit home as a gay man. Mm-hmm. She does a clip on, Islamophobia and but Islam is all about peace. Islam is all about tolerance. You're bigoted if you're, right? I mean, that is so removed from reality. Now, that doesn't mean that the great majority of Muslims are not wonderful, kind, and lovely people. I would know that better than most because I've interacted growing up with most Muslims. And most are lovely people, just like most people of any other group are either nice or not. But when we speak about specific Islamic doctrines, to get up on a 4-minute video and say the most profoundly, not only idiotic, but falsifiable things, is offensive because it negates the real realities of hundreds of millions of people who are experiencing the horrifying things that they're experiencing in large part because of specific Islamic doctrines. So, and I say as a gay man, why don't you go to one of a bunch of countries in that region and wear a t-shirt that says proudly, I am a gay man, and report back to us on the tolerance that you experience. So
I think we know that I would be found thrown from a building.
There you go. So what I don't like about her is in her quest to always take the progressive, culturally relativist, she is adding to the problem by creating an environment where people are afraid to speak the truth about very serious issues. There are elements of many religious doctrines that are not consistent with the liberal values that you and I would hold dear. Let's talk about them honestly, whether they exist in Mormonism or in Judaism or in Islam. So don't get up and give me bullshit for four minutes as a guy who escaped execution in Lebanon from your bullshit office in New York about how everybody is peaceful and loving. That offends me. And so in that sense, she embodies those types of social justice warrior qualities that I dislike.
I think I'm with you on that, but solely because it is provably false.
Right.
I'm an atheist, and I would tell you that I get more stick, not in England, obviously, where that's just normal.
Right.
But in America, that I get more stick for that than being gay or black or anything else.
Right.
But the combination of all of them together makes me some kind of horrific monster.
You're Lucifer.
Yeah, that's here to bring on the second coming, or whatever your end of days thing, depending on your book.
Right.
But I do think you're right that you can't pretend that doctrine of all religions, actually,
right,
has got dangerous bits in it. Mormons not allowing black people in their religion until the late 60s or early 70s. Any number of ridiculous things. People who think and believe there's magic underwear. People who believe that a wafer turns into a body of a deity. All of this stuff is nonsense. And I don't mean... I mean, that's not even... I'm not using that in kind of a blaspheming sense, though I don't think that should even exist.
Right, exactly.
But I'm simply saying, factually, we can prove that wrong.
Right.
Right now. We don't need to wait for more science.
Right.
We can just prove it wrong. The flat earthers... And maybe you can explain to me. I can't understand why this is a new thing now. I've heard more about flat earth in the last year than I have heard the entire previous of my life.
You're talking about the rapper who came out, right? Is that the guy?
Well, he's one of them. Yeah, but everywhere I look now, and that's I know there's a psychological phenomenon of that.
Right, exactly.
But it seems now it's something that people have grabbed hold of, and it's acceptable. Right. I mean, the level of incredulity.
It's incredible.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I just think that some of what she... I've only seen this one video.
Right.
But it seems to me that telling people, if people don't like to be referred to in this way, don't.
Right.
It just seems reasonable.
I agree.
You know, I had a coach who loved to call me boy.
Okay.
And I can tell you, if there's a way to... I don't do physical violence. I don't do physical anything. That's why I'm twice the man I used to be. But if there's a way to engage me in physical violence, it's to call me boy.
Right. Because it demeans you.
No one with a brain should be unaware of the connotation of that. And that's not even an American thing now. There's enough of American culture everywhere, from the Dukes of Hazzard way back when to what we've got today, to know that you just don't do that.
Right.
And so I think it's ridiculous that I have to ask the man to not do it. And I think it would be even more ridiculous if he said it's my right as free speech to say what I want.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's the part where we're not in the same space. But that's what I think.
Fair enough. I mean, look, what you're basically saying, and I've actually made the exact same point, the fact that you have freedom of speech doesn't mean that you walk around, insult, and hurt people, right? Because then, of course, as you correctly said, there are social consequences to you being an asshole. When we're talking about freedom of speech, we're talking about... Should there be institutionalized mechanisms that restrain your capacity to be an asshole and a racist? And the answer is no, exactly. So this is why, as a Jewish person, incidentally, I'm also an atheist, but as a person of a Jewish background, if I can put it that way, I strongly stand with the right of the Holocaust denier, right? The Holocaust denier is roughly in the same club as the flat earth member, right? They exist in the same space. But I think he has the right to stand out and espouse truly offensive things to me, such as denying the Holocaust and the eradication of my people close to 70 years ago. He's got a right to be an asshole. This idea that there is freedom of speech, but there is no but. The only buts are don't scream the proverbial fire in the theater, don't defame, don't say libelous thing. All other bets are off. You can say whatever you want.
I would say this. My one thing with this is that I don't want to have to pay for that to happen.
Right.
For that man to speak or that woman to speak.
Fair enough.
I want that person to not be able to claim, and it won't happen in terms of the Holocaust denier perhaps, but we know that there are plenty of people who say horrible things about gay people, black people, women. And then they say, you can't say anything to me because that's blasphemy.
Right.
Because this is my religion is somehow protected. And so I don't think that's the case. And I think there is a right to, if you don't like what they're saying, to not listen to it. I personally am more for listening to it, asking questions, and showing my contempt in person. Right. That's more who I am. But I do think there are some people of a constitution who just... They don't want to listen to someone talk for 2 hours about being a Holocaust denier with all their evidence about that.
Right, right. But the beautiful thing is to link it back to our you know basketball conversation. If we're playing fairly in basketball, nobody has their one hand tied behind their back, right?
Yep.
So things like political correctness or safe spaces or literally institutionalized blasphemy laws or anything that it's creating. The conditions where one group has their hand, metaphorically tied behind their back. I can't say this because I'll be blaspheming. It's an open court battle of ideas. Let the best idea wins. That's how great things get done in science, in economics, in politics, freedom for everything is the way a healthy society evolves. And so I've spoken about this. I'm not sure if you've watched my clip. I recently spoke at the University of Ottawa on political correctness, and I gave examples.
I saw that.
Oh, you watched it? Okay, great. Thank you. And as you saw, I mean, there are just incredible examples. Just today, I shared a clip or a link to somebody at Northwestern University. I mean, a very prestigious university that was triggered and made made to feel unsafe by a burlesque show, right? So this has gotten to a level where it is almost as if it's satire, right? We've got to put an end to this. We've got to make the fulcrum start swinging the other way, right?
Yeah, I don't know what's happening with trigger warnings. and I don't know what's... because I think it's fair to say... I mean, I when I go to America, I watch... There's a channel, I don't know what it is, USA Today, USA, sorry, or something like that, that has Law and Order just back to back to back to back.
Right.
And I've seen them all before, but it's just one of those generic shows my brain can turn off to. And before them, it says, it always goes, before the da-da comes on, it always has the little warning, this contains graphic something else. And I'm not worried about that.
Right.
I'm not concerned about it for myself. I don't feel it impinges on anything of mine to have that to tell some mother to turn the television off if she's watching with her seven-year-old. I've got no issue with that. I think the trigger warning thing goes a level beyond that because it seems to be letting you know that you, I think, surely the trigger warning in classes should be, by the way, you're going to be challenged in this. If you have an idea that you can't evidence, you're going to be challenged. If you have an idea that has been disproven over time by a body of scientists, then you're going to be challenged. And we expect you to bring your challenge to the stuff that is heard both from your professor and from your colleagues in this classroom, because that's how we learn. I do think that in universities right now, it seems like the most base and unsophisticated use of the word safe space.
Right.
Because I think you can have a super high-level, charged, challenging space that is also safe exactly. for the meekest of people to step up and speak.
Exactly.
And I don't... All that is it feels to me like real institutional laziness.
Well,
like I don't want to be bothered. I don't want to be bothered creating. And I do understand there are some people now who are actively. You showed the video clip of the young woman from
Yale,
perhaps.
Oh yeah.
And I can't. I looked at that and all I thought is this is like a Kardashian moment. This is all about her.
Yeah.
This is not about social. I like social justice as an idea. This is not about social justice. This is about you.
Right.
This is about you going viral.
Right. Well, I've given the analogy of, look, in some countries, if you say things that I don't like, I literally behead you. In other countries, I can't behead you, but I can behead your reputation. This is what you do to guys like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins. And fortunately, I haven't had... guys coming after me.
You're next.
I'm next. Oh my goodness. But now the other way that I could control what you say is by coming up with new social mechanisms to keep you quiet. It might be through not what you and I might call good social justice, but social justice warriors as a pejorative term, political correctness, safe spaces, trigger warnings, microaggressions. These are all mechanisms by which ultimately, I mean, yes, it's part of the sort of the ethos of victimology, but it's also about control, right? If I could constantly scream victimhood every time John utters something that might be challenging to my position, I win the NBA title, right? And so I think there is a sinister, if you like, totalitarian bent to these movements. And the quicker public figures stand up and push back against this, the quicker we'll resolve this problem. And this is why I do what I do. I mean, look, I do this at great cost to come out, right? But I just feel that if we don't do it, I mean, I'll just give you a very quick example, and I know we have to wrap up soon. I received an email, I, of course, I won't mention who it is, just 2 days ago from a student who was telling me about some of the challenges he's experiencing at Concordia because he's Jewish, because of some of the demographic realities that are happening. And incidentally, I've had several other students over the past few years come and approach me with that. And so I suggested to him, don't stay in the proverbial closet. Come out. Shine a light on this, right? And so bottom line is, you only defeat bad ideas by providing better ideas. And anybody that tries to stifle that process is my enemy, and undoubtedly yours. That's the bottom line.
I think one of my issues with how we move this forward is that there are perfectly acceptable terms that, in my understanding, aren't problematic. Right. Political correctness, it's not a term I've ever really, you know, took both hands up and said, yeah, I like this. But how I understand it is not how it is currently used. Microaggressions. Right. How I understand it is not how it's currently used. The fact is that I have never, ever waited to use a cash machine. Ever.
Right.
Because I know that if I show up at a cash machine, especially if I'm not wearing a suit, that all I have to do is take a step forward and smile when the person turns around. They will cancel their transaction and walk away. This happened today at Euston train station, just right here.
Right.
I was in a hurry. I took one step, just maybe a quarter of a step closer than a British person might normally take. They cancel the transaction. I managed to get my money and go to the train.
Right.
But what they did is most certainly a microaggression.
Right. Right.
But it doesn't have to go into this kind of, I don't know, Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole.
Right.
That people go with it. But because they are true. They're real.
Right.
They do have an impact on people's organizational culture and society.
Right.
But because this is treading in your space, and I'm sorry to... But you would know that some of these things have an evolutionary bent that's way beyond just the fact that I'm black, but also the fact that I'm massive. And
the fact that you're male.
That I'm male, and this triggers stuff in people that isn't just about the fact that how I look. You know, the fact that I've been stopped and searched in London 4 times since last March is probably something a bit more microaggressive. But I just think it seems like these words have been appropriated probably at some point early on in the best of intentions.
Exactly.
But now it leads to young women who are not, the gender of her is important, young people in universities screaming at professors, I read the letter, the email that he wrote, or the submission, sorry, he wrote, I didn't think it was particularly provocative.
Right. Right.
And it seemed like the response was as if he was wearing a white hood. And also, the thing, and you picked up on this, I know already, so we're back in agreement again, but the thing that really got me was that this is not a place, I don't remember the exact words, this is not a place for intellect, this is a place to be made like home or something like that.
Yes,
and it's like, no, this is supposed to be a safe space for intellectual curiosity to thrive, with all that entails, with all the number of times, like you and I, that we come home knowing that somebody from the University of Rochester, somebody from the university or somewhere else has disproven something that we really were kind of fond of.
Exactly. And incidentally, I really think that, I'd like to think that this is nothing but a little bleep on the radar, and that eventually this will autocorrect itself. Now, one of the reasons why I am so public about it is just, well, number one, just because that's my nature. I don't hold back. But also because it gives, very much like how when you came out of the proverbial gay closet, because it's going to also motivate the little kid in Iowa from not feeling bad about himself. By me standing up, I then motivate others to speak out. And you can't imagine the number of emails, or probably you can imagine, the number of emails that I receive from people saying, thank you, this has now given me the courage to speak at my departmental meeting, to challenge my professor when he says something, right? So this is why we do what we do, is because to the extent that, I mean, and of course you're much more known than I am, but to the extent that we've got a public platform, we could use that platform to in our small way, shape the conversation. And so when my wife sometimes tells me, well, you know, why do you have to be the grand martyr and take this on? Well, it's not that I'm a grand martyr. It's because I know that I can contribute to the discourse, and then I would feel remiss in not participating. It's my job. It's my duty to participate in the discourse. And we each do it in our own respective ways, right?
Exactly right. I mean, it's important. We know it's important for people to have role models in the broadest sense of it. It's important for people to know that, in a weird way, you talked about Justin Fashanu.
Yes.
The lesson he taught people early on was that if you come out, you die.
Right.
Your brother will sacrifice you. Your mentor and coach will abuse you, and then you will have nothing better but to kill yourself. So it's important that there are people out there who aren't metaphorically dying,
right,
but are thriving whilst throwing out these ideas so that people can follow. You know, I don't think I get the animus you do. I think you have a unique voice in this space. And
thank you.
But I try and be extraordinarily frank and say what I think. And I do know that by doing that, there is a section of business that I can never have. There are companies that I can never work with. There are all kinds of opportunities that disappear. But I think it's important. I'm not always right, but I'm always well thought through. I've done as much research as I'm capable of. And then if I'm wrong and people can evidence it, I'm all over
that. Right. And you go to sleep with a clear conscience knowing that you were true to yourself. I mean, to me, you know, I was chatting with my wife recently and I said, you know, I don't understand when people, you know, engage in self-deception. Because to me, I really have a mechanism where at the end of the day, when I lay down in the privacy of my thought in my bed, I know that I am integral, I'm whole, in that I haven't sacrificed anything of my integrity, my views, in the pursuit of something. I'm always true. I could be wrong, and then you prove me wrong, that's perfectly fine. But I always did think truthfully and honestly to the best of my abilities. And that makes me go to bed at night very well. And
I mean, being honestly authentic has nothing to do with the truth or not.
Exactly.
It is a process that we go through, and there is something deeply attractive about it to other people.
Yeah.
And again, maybe this is in your space, not mine, but you know that people who are authentic, even if they are not correct in every way, perfect in every way, if you know that what they say is what they believe, we're back to those that business-like website. This is who we say we are, and this is who we actually are. That incongruence attracts no one.
It's interesting because if we link it to the political discussion, one of the problems, for example, that Hillary Clinton is facing right now, and say one of the things that's making Donald Trump attractive, is exactly the issue of authenticity that you're talking about, right? She's perceived as somebody who is, you know, manipulative, duplicitous, Machiavellian, rightly or wrongly. He's perceived as, I mean, yes, he's a bit rough around the edges. We could certainly polish those edges. But you know what? He's authentic. He speaks his mind. And for a large segment of the American populace, that is viewed as being honest, being an outsider to a corrupt political system. And so he wins the authenticity battle, correct?
Yeah, he does win the authenticity battle. And I think partly because people have conflated authenticity with honesty.
Right.
In terms of external honesty of ideas.
Right.
Because I don't know if he believes some of the stuff he says.
Right.
And so I'm not sure that's true. There was a really interesting study. I know we've gone on forever, but really interesting study about the characteristic that most defined the people who enjoy, follow, support Donald Trump. And it wasn't a race, because often there's a real temptation. In my head, I want that to be, you're stupid, undereducated, and that's why you like him.
Right.
Whilst there was some factoring in that area of level of education with support for Donald Trump, the big thing was the authoritarian nature.
Right.
You know, and Karen Stenner, she wrote the book. She wrote, she's remarkable, from Princeton, professor there, at least she was when she wrote the book.
Okay.
She wrote a book called The Authoritarian Dynamic, which is an absolute work study on the idea of authoritarianism as an approach to the world.
Right.
You know, the deep abiding love of structure, the want to get instruction, the very concrete ideas of good and bad, very traditional ideas of good and bad. These people, they adore Donald Trump.
Right.
And I don't, in a sense, I look at it and I don't really understand why, because I don't look at him and see a man who's ever abided by the rules particularly, unless he could make the rules work for him in a loophole-y kind of way. This is the guy who wants to build walls with Mexico but has factories there making his ties. He wants to do stuff with China to cut them off from trade, and yet his shirts are made there. It's so incongruent to me, but you're absolutely right. He appears so authentic, which only highlights Hillary's political longevity, which makes her intrinsically untrustworthy.
Well, I'm going to tell you who is authentic. My man John is authentic. I could keep you here for another 5 hours, but I think we'll break the internet. So for the purposes of trying to maintain the integrity of the internet, I will, with much regret, end it now. But hey, John, do you have anything that you'd like? I'm going to put a bunch of links in the descriptor section, but is there anything, any projects that you are working on right now that you'd like to promote before we wrap this baby up?
The big thing is, well, I don't know if it's a big thing, but the thing is, my book did pretty well, New York Times bestseller back in 2007. I am re-releasing it now.
This is Man in the Middle.
Man in the Middle.
Yeah.
I'm re-releasing it. It's not available yet, but it will be in March, end of March. Re-releasing it with a ton of new stuff based on some of the work I'm doing now, a lot of the things that we're talking about, bits about humanism, bits about organizational development. I think it'll be... I tell a decent story, so hopefully people will enjoy.
Fantastic. Hey, John, thank you so much. Stay on the line, but I'll stop the recording right now. Guys, please share this video. Talk to you soon. Cheers.